This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 28, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, U.S. lawmakers vote to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act, but advocates say government budget cuts may threaten services the act is designed to guarantee. Bradley Manning testifies in a military court explaining his reasons for leaking documents to WikiLeaks. And Wisconsin Senate passes a controversial bill to pave the way for a massive iron ore mine, but tribal communities vow to fight it.
Because it represents genocide, an abrogation of treaty rights, a poisoning of groundwater aquifers.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Two Northwest activists who refused to testify before a grand jury will walk free today after a federal judge ordered their release. The grand jury was thought to be investigating a 2012 May Day protest action in Seattle. FSRN's Devin Terrio Orr reports from Washington.
Catherine Olegnik and Matt Duran have not been accused of a crime, yet they were imprisoned in a federal detention center for 5 months for failing to respond to questions from a federal grand jury. The two have spent several months in solitary confinement, 23 hours a day in their cell with only one 15-minute phone call a month. In a decision late Wednesday, Federal District Judge Richard A. Jones ordered their immediate release. He cited their deteriorating health and testimony from Olegnik and Duran, stating that although they both wish to end their confinement, they will never do so by testifying. The judge noted that it could hold them for an additional 13 months, but the court reasoned the two must be released because their imprisonment for contempt must be intended to coerce testimony. The judge wrote that for these two, quote, their resolve appears to increase as their confinement continues. The two could still face criminal contempt charges for their refusal to testify, meaning they could eventually be detained again. A third so-called grand jury resister, Maddie Pfeiffer, is still being detained by federal authorities. Devin Terrio Orr, FSRN, Seattle.
Following up on a story from yesterday, Occupy activist Michael Primo was found not guilty by a jury in New York City this morning. Primo posted the verdict on Twitter today. He had been accused of resisting arrest and assaulting a police officer at a protest in late 2011, but he maintained his innocence. Primo turned down a plea deal, wanting to challenge the NYPD before a jury. Oil giant Royal Dutch Shell says it will delay plans to drill in the Arctic. This comes after two of the company's drilling rigs were incapacitated, one by extreme weather and the other by mechanical problems that could lead to fines or legal sanctions. Shell says the decision to pause in 2013 will give the company time to ensure readiness of people and equipment going forward. Environmental groups have long cited the dangers of Arctic drilling operations and have pressed the government to put a stop to oil exploration in the region. Today, President Obama swore in Jacob Lew as Secretary of the Treasury. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed his nomination with only moderate opposition from Republicans. Lew starts his job as Treasury head as government spending cuts, known as the sequester, are scheduled to take effect tomorrow. The independent financial reform group, Occupy the SEC, has filed a lawsuit against members of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, and other federal agencies. The activist group says the government has failed to coordinate to enact the Volcker Rule, which was supposed to take effect last summer. FSRN's Caroline Lewis reports.
The Volcker Rule is part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was passed in 2010. It is meant to prohibit banks with deposit accounts from making speculative investments for profit. The rule was passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis and prompted some firms to cut back on proprietary trading. But the activity still persists at some financial institutions, as the terms of the rule are debated in Congress. One of the defendants in the case, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, testified in Congress on Tuesday that regulators are making progress on the Volcker Rule. But Occupy the SEC attorney Akshat Tiwari says it no longer appears to be a priority. He hopes the lawsuit will pressure regulators to fulfill their duties.
It's largely a symbolic act because, you know, they're not asking for any money. Is basically to hold the regulators' feet to the fire, to let them know that the public is watching what they're doing. It's keeping track of their progress on these important pieces of legislation.
The Occupy the SEC plaintiffs have accounts at JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo and say their money is at risk as long as the Volcker Rule is not finalized. The Federal Reserve and the SEC did not immediately return a request for comment. Caroline Lewis, FSRN.
Journalists and press freedom organizations are calling for government action to protect the media after a series of attacks this week outside El Siglo de Torreón, a regional newspaper in northern Mexico. Gunmen in vehicles fired at federal police guarding the office on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week. Yesterday's attack killed a bystander who worked in the area and left a civilian and a federal police officer with bullet wounds. Earlier this month, five employees from the same newspaper were kidnapped, beaten, and released hours later. Opposition supporters in Guinea continue to fight with security forces in the streets of the capital today. The young protesters erected roadblocks, threw rocks, and burned tires to prevent vehicles and people from passing. They're protesting parliamentary elections scheduled for May. FSRN's Karim Kamara called in this report from Conakry.
Police used tear gas and batons to disperse the young protesters who gathered in the street on Wednesday. Nearly 150 people were wounded in clashes. A police officer died from his injuries last night. Government spokesperson Albert Damantan Kamara called for calm today. He told journalists that investigations have been launched into the violence and pledged that the culprit will be brought to justice. Opposition parties say the government is taking steps to suppress the vote of their supporters and are boycotting in the lead-up to the May elections. After demonstrations on Wednesday, they declared a city-wide strike, but the call to action failed to gain the support of most working Guineans. Karim Kamara, FSRN, Conakry.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, for the first time in his court-martial proceedings, Army Private Bradley Manning explained his reasons for passing military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks. Manning spoke at a military court in Maryland where he pleaded guilty to some offenses, including charges of unauthorized disclosure of specific records. The material he admits to leaking includes the video known as Collateral Murder that shows U.S. military helicopters shooting unarmed civilians in Iraq in 2007, killing a dozen people, including two Reuters staff, and wounding two children. The U.S. military originally said they were insurgents. Other leaked materials include State Department cables and documents on the Afghan War and Guantanamo. Manning pleaded not guilty to more serious charges, including aiding the enemy. He's been in military detention for more than 1,000 days. Journalist Kevin Gostola has been covering the case for Fire Dog Lake, and he joins us from Fort Meade, where he's been attending today's proceedings. Kevin Gostola, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
So what exactly did Bradley Manning plead guilty to today?
He was pleading to elements of the original charges. And it's easier to say what he didn't plead guilty to committing. He didn't plead guilty to aiding the enemy, to violating the Espionage Act, to violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or to committing violations of a federal larceny statute. He didn't say that he was stealing or had committed a theft when he took the information and it became information he had in his possession. What that leaves is pleading to the possession of the information, pleading to giving it to an unauthorized person, someone who wasn't authorized to receive the information, and then engaging in conduct that would be service discrediting the military.
And this is a rare occasion when Bradley Manning was able to speak on his own behalf. Did he talk about why he leaked this material?
As he described, in general, it appears that he took his analyst duty very seriously. He talked about how he would follow the Associated Press, Reuters, even Stratfor, a private intelligence firm, and WikiLeaks, and he would look at publications. He believed that he needed to go into information, be curious, read it thoroughly, and when he found something that was questionable, he decided that it was a duty to pursue the truth, to get those questions answered and to raise concerns. And when he found things, or the fact that the Reuters agency couldn't obtain a copy of the Apache helicopter attack video, commonly known to the public as Collateral Murder, when he found that they couldn't get that through the Freedom of Information Act request, what he then decided to do was pass it on to WikiLeaks. And he even made a copy that he wanted to personally give to Reuters in London just so that they could have it and try to the Defense Department that the video, in fact, exists.
And in addition to that video, a lot of this other material, unvarnished field reports from Iraq, information on Afghanistan, painted a very different picture from the official line of the U.S. role in these conflicts.
Right, and he believed that these needed to be out in the public for Americans to have a debate about counterinsurgency tactics. And he actually specifically said in his statement that he was concerned of the impact that the counterinsurgency strategies were having on innocent people that he described as living in the pressure cooker environment of asymmetric warfare. And he believed that we were alienating more people than we were helping them. And so he made this statement. And I think something that your listeners would find quite profound, and I found it profound as somebody who's been following this very closely, is that Bradley Manning himself did not intend to release the war logs to WikiLeaks at first. In fact, he was going to go through establishment press organizations. He was going to provide the information to, he called it the Washington Post. A woman did not seem interested in getting the information. He didn't think he took him seriously. So, she hung up, and that was that. He contacted the New York Times. He left a message. He left his email address and a Skype address describing the information. It was important. He didn't hear anything back from the New York Times.
And Kevin Gostola, what's next in the court proceedings?
He can't be found not guilty during trial. No matter what happens going forward, he will be convicted, and he will be guilty, and he will go to jail for a certain amount of time. Now the question becomes, how long will he be in prison? If he's found guilty of these lesser offenses he's pleading to, the maximum of 20 years, and so he would be in jail for that period, potentially. But if the government proves their case, the other charges, the charges he was in pleading guilty, he could still be in prison for life without parole.
That was journalist Kevin Gostola, co-author of the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning, speaking to us from the military court at Fort Meade. Kevin, thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Dorian.
The House of Representatives reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act today and rejected a Republican amendment that would have stripped out protections for LGBT people, undocumented women, and Native American tribal members. President Obama has promised to sign it as soon as it reaches his desk, but some lawmakers and women's rights advocates say the upcoming budget sequester could cut back on many of the same services for abused women that the bill renews. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The Democratic side of the House floor erupted in cheers this morning as the screen on the wall showed that the Violence Against Women Act had enough votes to pass, while a Republican-backed substitute failed to muster support. Immediately after the vote, Arizona Democrat Ann Kirkpatrick, who was born and raised on an Apache reservation, told FSRN what the bill's reauthorization means for her home state.
This bill passing is a major, major victory for women everywhere, but especially Native American women, because they are 2.5 times more likely to be assaulted in their lifetimes than other women. And as you know, I represent 12 tribes. I'm wearing today a necklace that was made by an Apache woman where I grew up, and it's a real symbol of the fact that we need to treat and protect all women the same. So this is a big victory.
The version passed by the House and Senate after more than a year of political gridlock expands the legal protections in the original law to Native Americans and LGBT people, and expands the number of visas available for undocumented women who report abuse. The failed Republican substitute bill would have restricted this provision, only providing visas to undocumented violence survivors if federal or local law officials certify that doing so would help prosecute criminal activity. That bill also stripped out language outlining protections for LGBT domestic violence survivors, who often face discrimination from emergency service providers.
We need to treat all victims the same. Violence is violence.
That's Scott Berkowitz with the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, or RAIN. He said his organization has received several reports, mainly from rural areas, of police refusing to investigate domestic violence between same-sex couples, and of LGBT violence survivors being turned away from shelters and denied restraining orders against their partners. Berkowitz also highlighted a provision in the bipartisan bill that creates a transparent national database of the backlog of rape kits around the country that haven't been tested, a problem he said denies justice to survivors and endangers public safety.
It's an incredibly hard thing for a victim to go through. They have to, it typically takes several hours where they're sitting in an emergency room and the nurse is trying to recover any piece of forensic evidence from their body, from their clothing, and so forth. So in about 400,000 cases, victims have sat through this process, and then the evidence kit just got put on a shelf. It never got sent to the DNA lab to see if it matches any known criminals.
House Republican leaders refused to hold a vote on the bill for more than a year, which caused it to expire last term. When their version without these provisions came up for a vote Thursday, Wisconsin Democrat Gwen Moore blasted the exclusion, referencing Sojourner Truth's famous "Ain't I a Woman" speech.
As I think about the LGBT victims that are not here, the Native women who are not here, the immigrants who are not included in this bill, I would say, as Sojourner Truth would say, ain't they women? They deserve protections. When we talk about the constitutional rights, don't women on tribal lands deserve their constitutional right of equal protection and not to be raped and battered and beaten and dragged back onto native lands because they know they can be raped with impunity? Ain't they women?
Moore, who has spoken openly about her personal experiences as a survivor of rape, explained that her version of the bill, which passed Thursday and is now headed to the president's desk, allows tribal courts to prosecute non-Native perpetrators who abuse Native women. Yet the many programs funded by the law could be drastically cut back if the automatic cuts in the budget sequester go into effect Friday as scheduled. The Justice Department estimated earlier this month that Violence Against Women Act programs, including training for law enforcement and prosecutors, shelters for survivors, and analysis of DNA evidence in rape kits, could lose $20 million. They estimate this will cut services for nearly 36,000 women. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
You're listening to FSRN to stay on top of all of our stories, including the latest on immigration reform, climate change action, reproductive rights, and dispatches from around the world. Follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Have a news tip or comment? You can reach us, comments@fsrn.org. For our documentaries and special coverage and to support FSRN's grassroots journalism from around the world, visit our website, fsrn.org. Wisconsin is one step closer to developing one of the world's largest iron ore mines. The state Senate passed a bill last night which weakens key environmental protections and clears the way for an open pit mine near the shores of Lake Superior. As Molly Stentz from WORT-FM in Madison reports, Native American tribes that live near the proposed mine are vowing to stop it.
The marble walls of the Wisconsin State Capitol boomed with the sounds of tribal drumming and chanting on Wednesday. Members of Wisconsin's Native American tribes came to witness the state Senate vote on the bill that could open up a new iron ore pit mine, one they say could destroy their way of life. The bill changes a host of environmental and zoning laws to allow a mining company more latitude in dumping waste. It also limits the amount of money a mining company could be charged for a permit, shifting potential costs to taxpayers. Freshman Senator Tom Tiffany is the chair of the Senate Mining Committee. He says that jobs in northern Wisconsin are sorely needed and that mining could be done responsibly.
I've seen this argument that it's jobs versus the environment. That's not where we're at in this country at this point. We can do these things. The know-how and technology that we have is completely different than 50 years ago.
After nearly 8 hours of debate, the state Senate approved the bill by one vote. All Democrats were against it, along with one lone Republican senator, Dale Schultz.
The people in northern Wisconsin, as been pointed out, have said repeatedly that they don't want to trade their pristine environment for the possibilities of a boom and bust cycle of jobs in the mining industry.
While the mining bill is on the fast track to becoming law, what might stop the mine itself are the native tribes that live downstream. The Bad River Band of Ojibwa oppose mining in the Pinoakee Hills because they say mine waste could pollute their trout streams, wild rice crops, and drinking water. Mike Wiggins Jr. is the tribal chairman, and he says that there will be no mine.
Because it represents genocide, an abrogation of treaty rights, a poisoning of groundwater aquifers, and, no nation, including Wisconsin as a state, would want to have sulfuric acid coming down the pipe and heavy metals in the groundwater aquifers that they depend on, you know, and quench the thirst of their children with.
Members of the Bad River, Red Cliff, and Lacouture Ojibwa Nations point out that they've lived near Lake Superior long before the Wisconsin state government existed. Ojibwa member Paul Domain says that they'll be there long after the current legislature comes and goes.
And people cannot guarantee us. These legislators that say, wow, we're going to look out for your concerns, will be dead and gone when some of the possible impacts of this mine are going to come up. How do we hold them accountable then?
The Bad River Tribe says they'll sue the state if they have to protect their nation. And Tribal Chair Wiggins says their actions likely won't stop there.
Ultimately, our activism is going to encapsulate whatever it takes to protect ourselves. So.
The mining bill now heads to the Republican-controlled Assembly, where it is expected to pass. Governor Scott Walker has promised to sign the bill. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
In Yemen, this week marks the one-year anniversary of the transition of power from longtime leader Ali Abdullah Saleh to current President Mansour Hadi, and large crowds gathered in Sana'a Wednesday to mark the occasion. Political groups are scheduled to convene in just over 2 weeks to work on a new constitution, but some of those who went to the streets in protests that led to Saleh's removal say the government has failed to ensure security and to prevent destabilizing outside interventions such as U.S. airstrikes and drone attacks. They also criticize Saleh, who was granted immunity from prosecution as part of a deal to relinquish power in 2012. Many of his allies remain in powerful government positions. For more, we go to Sana'a to speak with Sarah Jamal Ahmed. She's a civic activist and co-founder of the Support Yemen Break the Silence campaign. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Representatives are set to meet to shape the new constitution. What are your primary concerns or priorities in this process?
I think the number one priority for people like me would be having assurance in the constitution of the shape of the coming country, that it won't be a new theocracy or a new military dictatorship, that it's going to be a civil state that grants people social justice and equal opportunities and freedom of speech and expression. Also concerned about citizenship in the constitution. The Yemeni constitution witnessed some significant setbacks since the southern constitution that was slightly changed in 1978, and then the unity constitution in 1990, and finally the latest constitution that was changed in 1994 as a result of the civil war back then, that messed up a lot with the citizenship articles and amendments in the constitution. Women went down from being full citizens in the Constitution, from being treated in the public space as citizens, to attachments of men.
Well, let's take the issue of the role of women in the Yemen society. You are also a gender researcher with the Yemen Polling Center. How would you specifically like to see that guarantee of equality in a new government set up in Yemen?
Well, I always have the same answer for this question. Political powers in Yemen used women during the protests. They used them as members in front of the cameras. The moment the protests were over, all political parties, including right, left, and all sorts of powers, said thank you to women. Now it's time for you to go back home. Not a single party has a woman as a leader of the party or as a general secretary. Not a single party has women on top of their agendas.
And what about the youth, the young women in particular, who were very active during the protests and went out into the streets? Where are they and how are they involved?
Well, they still exist because I strongly disagree with the argument that says that Yemeni women or young and old and even youth suddenly appeared in 2011. We're not a segregated society, not the way that certain wings of media like to portray us. Women have always been on the street, if not protesting, then at least working day by day next to men on the field and as workers and farmers and so on. Where are they now? Women and youth are back to the stage of astonishment. The regime managed to normalize between the street and protest. Protests are not strange anymore. You can see a protest passing by and people acting normally as if it doesn't exist anymore because this tool has been overused and it doesn't work anymore. I think people now are more concerned about their security.
So security is a major issue, and you mentioned how direct protests or protests in the streets are becoming less effective in your view. What will you be looking for in the coming weeks ahead of this meeting on the Constitution in order to highlight some of these reforms that you've outlined?
Again, at this point, yes, I am an activist, but at the end of the day, I am a Yemeni woman, a citizen, who is afraid to go home sometimes and see people shooting each other on the street. If the international community cares about the national dialogue being successful, then they should make sure that civil security is achieved. U.S. counterterrorism of airstrikes and signature drones is not helpful for the national dialogue. It's not helpful for their AQAP fights. Supporting certain powers. I mean, international interference, like Saudi Arabia supporting the Muslim Brotherhood or Iran supporting Houthis, is also not helpful. All those powers must understand that making Yemenis fight their own wars on their land is not useful for the national dialogue. If we don't have real security, then all the discussions in the national dialogue will just be more of a picture-taking event and not a real resolution that uproots violence and uproots 33 years of accumulative problems that Saleh created with his partners who are still in office today.
Sarah Jamal Ahmed is an activist and sociologist. She's also the co-founder of the Support Yemen Break the Silence campaign. She joined us from Sana'a. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Shannon Young and Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.